Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour has just returned from a three-week expedition sponsored by the Geological Society of America. The purpose was to explore global warming, to look at the history of exploration and exploitation, the sealing and whaling of the remote region, the islands of Antarctica and the Great Southern Ocean, as well as the peninsula of the mainland continent. George has been with us before. He teaches a range of courses in earth sciences at MATC here in Milwaukee. He also is the chair of the annual Green Energy Summit and founder and moderator of the annual Green Vehicles Workshop. He says that this trip was very exciting, and it was also frightening in some ways. He's going to be talking about it, giving a briefing at the Sustainability Summit in March. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. The president, as you know, paid attention to global warming in his inaugural address last week, and George Thomas Stone was pleased that he did so. Will we see any action? What did George see on a three-week expedition to this remote part of the world? We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, if you'd like to message us there is, or leave a message there is, proper use of English, the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, George. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, good morning, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Have you been to that part of the world before, George?
No, this was my first trip to Antarctica, and it was very exciting and very rewarding.
And the purpose of it, the Geological Society of America gathered prominent scientists, people interested in global warming dominantly. Was that the reason for the trip?
Well, it was one of the reasons. This year, 2013, is the 125th anniversary of the founding of the Geological Society of America, mm-hmm. GSA. Just as it was, by coincidence, the 125th anniversary of the founding of the National Geographic Society, which is probably better known among the general public. But the GSA, the Geological Society, wanted to and is sponsoring a number of special events to celebrate this 125th anniversary. And this expedition to Antarctica was one of them. It had a number of points of special interest. One was climate change as evidenced down in Antarctica, global warming. And another was the geologic history and the structural history, the tectonics, as geologists call it, of that region. The wildlife, the circulation of the Great Southern Ocean down there, changes that are going on in the climate, and of course the history of exploration, the history of sealing and whaling and settlement such as there is in the Antarctic region. All of these were areas of focus, and it was just a fascinating trip, a three-week cruise on a ship which had been built as a Soviet spy ship.
Oh my goodness, really?
Yeah, it was built in the 80s when the Soviet Union was still existed, and its purpose was to detect radio transmissions. And it still has the both low-frequency and high-frequency radio antennas for detecting transmissions on board. But after the collapse of the Soviet Union, this ship was recommissioned as a Russian research and tour vessel, and the Geological Society of America contracted through an agent to use this ship for our tour, and it was quite marvelous. It's not a huge ship. It held 100 passengers in addition to the crew and the staff, and the accommodations were not luxurious, but they were comfortable. And we set about 3 weeks of cruising from island to island and down along the Antarctic Peninsula to see what we could see, and it was just most rewarding in every way.
Mm-hmm. And there were a number of scientists on the journey, weren't there, George?
Yes, indeed, there were, including Richard Alley from Penn State, who is one of the world's leading climate scientists, Rob Dunbar from Stanford, similarly a highly esteemed scientist who's been studying Antarctica for decades, Ian DeLille from the University of Texas, who's a geologist who's been studying the geologic history of that region for decades. And so it was a group enriched by many experts in the area, and also a couple of historians who knew the history of the exploration, and wildlife experts as well. So it was a great group.
And what did you see? A broad question, but answer it in many ways. What evidence did you see and your fellow passengers and scientists see of global warming?
Well, we saw that many of the glaciers coming down from the mountain ranges of the Antarctic Peninsula, as well as the surrounding islands, are retreating rapidly, melting back, and that's true worldwide because of rising temperatures. We also saw where the huge ice shelf, which fringes the Antarctic Peninsula as well as the entire continent, has been breaking up and creating gigantic icebergs. And we saw many, many of these huge icebergs that had broken off of the ice shelf. And we also learned of the redistribution. We saw more penguins than you could possibly dream of.
Oh, did you?
Oh, yeah. We saw seven of there are eight different species of penguins in the Antarctic region, and we saw seven of them. And we learned how their distribution has been changing. Those who are more sensitive to warming temperatures are shrinking. Their range is shrinking. Those who are more adaptable to the warmer temperatures are replacing them. So it's having an impact on the distribution of the wildlife, no question about that.
Those icebergs, because of global warming, does that make traveling in that area difficult? Don't you worry you might run into
it? As a matter of fact, with modern radar and satellite imagery and GPS, it's fairly easy to keep track of where they are and avoid them, and so there's no real danger of a Titanic kind of collision. But nonetheless, we went into one bay. The way this worked was that we lived on the ship, and we went ashore in many places on these little rubber boats called Zodiacs, and they're driven by 60 horsepower outboard motors, and they hold 10 passengers at a time, and they're kind of like large rubber rafts, and you sit on the outside with your legs on the inside and hang onto a rope, and it's very exciting. But that's how we went ashore, and the main ship would go into, it was called the Academic Iofi. It would go into a bay or an inlet and drop anchor, and then the Zodiacs would carry the passengers a half a mile, a mile, 2 miles, those who wanted to go, into the beach or to the shore where we'd get off and hike around and see what we could see. One time, by the time all the Zodiacs brought the passengers back in the evening, the icebergs had drifted in and practically closed off the entrance to the bay.
Oh, my.
So we weren't in danger of an unintentional collision, but we were in some danger of not being able to get out for a long time. But very skillful maneuvering by the captain and the crew.
Yeah.
We did get out.
The captain and the crew were from where?
What Russia. Country? They were Russian.
They were from Russia.
Yeah.
Oh. And were there scientific experiments being conducted?
There were measurements being taken all the time, and both onshore and in the water in the atmosphere. So a lot of data was gathered on the expedition. And some people collected rock samples and took measurements on the land. And so, and there were census data gathered regarding the wildlife, the penguins and the seals. And you saw a lot of whales as well down in those cold waters of the Southern Ocean. Antarctica, as most people know, is a continent. It's covered largely by ice, by thick ice caps, ice sheets. They're really glaciers, continental-sized glaciers, similar to the continental glacier that covered much of eastern Canada and the northeastern United States back during the Ice Age, including much of Wisconsin. But they're still down there on Antarctica, and it's a continent covered largely by ice. The South Pole is there. But around it is water. You could think of it as the very southernmost part of the Pacific Ocean, the most southern part of the Atlantic, the southernmost part of the Indian Ocean. And so Antarctica is a continent completely surrounded by ocean, and the circulation around it is from west to east, or if you're looking up toward the South Pole from underneath the globe, it would be clockwise circulation. It's called the Antarctic circumpolar current. It's quite strong, and the narrowest place is between Cape Horn at the very southern tip of South America and the Antarctic Peninsula, where the gap is only about 400 miles, and the current moves quite rapidly through there. And it dominates a lot of the weather and a lot of the distribution of icebergs, wildlife distribution, including the marine life that lives in the ocean. And it's called the Great Southern Ocean, or simply the Southern Ocean, and is considered one of the seven seas, or the seven oceans of the planet. Mm. And it's notorious for its rough weather. And we did experience that a couple of times, where we had anywhere from 15 to 30-foot swells.
Ooh-wee!
Yeah, and so most of the people had some kind of motion sickness patch or pills right. along to, you know, guard against getting sick.
Right. It's hard not to with those kinds of swells. And you had so many scientists aboard. I'm interested in what all of you talked about. When you had your meals, you were all observing the effects of climate change, of global warming. What did you discuss?
Well, all kinds of things. Some were interested more in the wildlife and the effects of change on the distribution of the penguins and the whales. And one of the interesting topics was how human history down there, the sealers discovered these southern islands and Antarctica back in the 17th and 18th century. And then in the 19th century, the whalers discovered that these waters are very rich in many species of whales. And so they set up bases on the land from which they killed and harvested, I guess they would call it, millions over the years, millions of seals and whales, hundreds of thousands of whales. And so that human history, well, that changes when you take out a major component of the ecosystem in such large numbers for commercial reasons. Of course, it upsets the whole balance that had been established over hundreds of thousands, indeed millions of years. And then that has a domino effect and affects all the other species. And so a lot of the talk by the wildlife people was about how the human history down there had affected the ecosystem and what we can see of that now. But then, of course, the other major change is the change that's going on now and accelerating, and that's change in the climate. And there was a lot of discussion about that. And, you know, one of the great concerns is that the ice shelf that I mentioned, which is really frozen sea ice that fringes the continent, it acts as a barrier to the glaciers that are flowing out from the continent. The continent, like Greenland, is covered by a large continental ice sheet, and that is always flowing out from the center. It's a pile of ice which flows outward due to gravity. And the outflow glaciers, however, are kind of blocked by this frozen sea ice, this fringe or shelf of sea ice around the edge of the continent. And as that sea ice breaks up, and that's what forms those icebergs I mentioned, as that sea ice breaks up and the oceanic currents carry it away, that removes the barrier to the ice that's flowing out from the land, and those outflow glaciers accelerate. And that has the potential of releasing a lot of inland ice in the actual glaciers on the land. That has the potential of releasing a lot more of that ice to flow out into the ocean and ultimately melt and contribute to sea level rise. So there was a lot of discussion about that. Antarctica, the Antarctic Peninsula, let me be specific, the Antarctic Peninsula, which sticks like a great finger up from the Antarctic continent toward South America, is warming very rapidly. It's warming almost as fast as the Arctic. And we've heard a lot about the Arctic, how the Arctic Ocean reached a record minimum amount of ice last September, broke the old record by far. The Arctic, around the northern fringes of Canada, Alaska, and the Siberia, and the Arctic Ocean, has been warming between 3 and 7 degrees Fahrenheit in the last 50 years. It's a tremendous...
significant.
Yeah, very significant rate of warming. Well, the Antarctic Peninsula, that finger that sticks up towards South America, has been warming almost as fast. And lots of glacial retreat, sea ice breakup, the formation of icebergs, and so it's of great interest to climate scientists of what's going on down there. And the big question is, what effect will human-caused, and when I say global warming, I'm referring to human-caused climate change, or as the scientists say, anthropogenic climate change, being caused primarily by combustion of fossil fuels, but to a lesser extent by manufacture of cement and deforestation. Mm-hmm. Human-caused climate change has the potential ultimately to release enormous amounts of ice from Greenland and Antarctica. And that's the long-term great worry, that if we don't get this under control now, it might run away from us. And the melting of Greenland and Antarctica can cause enormous rise of sea level, which would inundate the coastlines of the world and be an inconceivably great environmental, human, and economic disaster. So those are these long-term questions, and we don't know where the tipping points are. We don't know when we've crossed a limit from which we can't go back. And so they're of great concern to the scientists, and they're also greatly concerned about the reluctance and the lack of progress in not only dealing with the problem and addressing solutions, developing, but even in recognizing the problem in many circles, both governmental and around the world. Mm-hmm. So those a lot of those topics were discussed over and over again.
I know that you were pleased to hear the president in his inaugural address address the issue of climate change, weren't you?
Yeah, I certainly was. And I think it's something that the president has been aware of. And, you know, the general political wisdom is that during his first term, he was very reluctant. His advisors cautioned him not to discuss or take positions on controversial subjects because then you lose votes. And of course, they wanted to win a second term. And I think that's part of the equation here, that the president felt more confident in being able to talk about more controversial topics in his second term, and especially in this second inaugural address. But yes, I think that those who are aware of and rightly concerned about the climate issue were heartened by his addressing it. He gave it almost a whole paragraph, more than any politician has given it, including himself, in memory. So this was great. And I think we want to give a little credit to James Hansen. Jim Hansen is the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, considered by many to be the world's leading climate scientist. And I know his remarks at the White House regarding our responsibility on January 15th, on the real Martin Luther King birth date, regarding our responsibility to future generations. This is the kind of moral responsibility, ethical responsibility that Dr. King focused on in his career and in his mission and in his great address in Washington in August of 63. And James Hansen has picked up that theme of intergenerational justice. And he really has been emphasizing this in his remarks at the White House and his communications with the White House. And I think I want to give him some of the credit for persuading President Obama to take up this topic. And I want to mention, if I may, that James Hansen will be coming to Milwaukee on March 7th, just about 6 weeks from now, to be the keynote speaker at the 10th Annual Sustainability Summit, which will be on March 6th and 7th at the Delta Center. That's Milwaukee's convention center, which has had many names over the years.
It sure has, George. Well, we hope to do a show on that, and we'd love to have him on the air with you as well. George Thomas Stone is our guest this hour. He's been studying climate change for many years, serves as chair of the annual Green Energy Summit, and has just returned from a three-week expedition to Antarctica to study climate change. It was a trip sponsored by the Geological Society of America, that organization celebrating its 125th anniversary this year. We have many people. Actually, our lines are jammed, so let me give you our email address, which is an alternative to the phone, because we don't want you to get frustrated and not have anybody answer the phone right now. I'll give you the phone in a moment, but the email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and the phone number, just give it a second and somebody will hang up after we talk to them, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. To you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we start our phone calls with Pat in Chicago. Hi, Pat. Hello, Pat.
Yeah, hi. I had a question about the global rise in temperature, and I know the last report for the U.S. is we've had the highest year or one of the highest year in the last 10 years or ever or very close to it. But the global temperature overall, the reports, at least some of the skeptics are citing, are saying it's the global temperature itself hasn't been rising for like the last 15 years. It's stuck. It's not going up at all. And I'm wondering if that can be addressed. I was also wondering, as kind of a combined question, of solar cycle 23, if I'm understanding it right, the output of the energy of the sun and the sunspots has been both delayed and lower than normal, and can that be affecting possible global warming, et cetera? Could it put a little stall in our rising? Could global solar output cause more problems in the future if it stalls and then increases suddenly? If your listener could, or your guest could address those two issues, that'd be great. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Sure, Pat. These are common questions raised by those who are informed by skeptics. First of all, the temperature, 10 of the warmest years on record have been since 1998. The temperature is continuing to rise globally, and heat, and this is really important, heat in immense quantities continues to be stored in the oceans, which of course cover 71% of the globe, and water has an enormous heat capacity. So the heat that's being stored from the trapping of heat by the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is really enormous. Now, there is one other effect. It's called the ENSO, or the El Niño Southern Oscillation, which occurs in the Pacific Ocean in the equatorial regions. And it's a function of how strong the trade winds, how strong the pressure gradient from east to west across the equatorial Pacific is, and that determines how strong the trade winds will be and whether or not they blow the surface waters off the west coast of South America across the Pacific more strongly or more weakly. If it's more strongly, which is what occurs during La Niña, which is the opposite of El Niño, then that brings up the removal of the surface waters or the blowing of the surface waters toward the west. That brings up deeper ocean water, which is cooler, to the surface. This has nothing to do with the sun. It has nothing to do with the atmospheric composition, or at least not directly. But it's adding cooler water to the surface waters of the ocean, and that has a cooling effect. And in recent years, we've had a significant number of weak to moderate La Niñas, and so that's had a countering effect to the global warming due to the trapping of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. That's settling down. It's kind of neutral now. But despite this, despite the addition of colder water from deeper levels in the Pacific Ocean, the planet is still warming. And so when we don't have La Niña, if we revert to an El Niño, we're going to see really dramatic jump in the temperature. So that's had a little bit of a dampening effect, but not to be confused with the overall trend, which is documented by just overwhelming evidence. Now, as to the solar cycles and the sunspots, those variations are trivial compared to the amount of heat that's being trapped by greenhouse gases. So yes, that continues to go on, but sunspots are not a significant influence on global temperature.
Thanks, Pat, for the call. We go to Ned in Knowlton. Hi, Ned.
Hi. I saw a documentary movie not long ago. It was in early January in Madison, called Chasing Ice, and this is a remarkable documentary.
Yes.
Which shows the decline of glaciers, and they described it as like a balloon in which the balloon is shrinking in all dimensions as you let the air out of it. not just length and width, but thickness as well of the glaciers. And they risk their lives positioning cameras on sheer edges of mountains and so on, trying to get continuous, and they do have continuous documentation since 2007 of glaciers shrinking extensively in Greenland, in northern Alaska, and so on around the world.
Right.
And it's just a fabulous documentary. And my second comment has to do with the Heartland Institute, which is a quasi-scientific bunch of deniers of climate change. So if people are interested in the denying side and want an objective view of it, take a look at that. And a book is out called Merchants of Doubt.
Great.
And that's got a good position also of explaining why these people, usually with a vested interest at stake, quite often with financial backing, are trying to counteract the 99% of scientists that are clearly with our guest. And I thank him for being on the air today.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you very much. What was your name?
His name is Ned.
Ned, thanks. You made some great points, Ned. Let me respond to them. The film you talk about, Chasing Ice, was made by and features James Blaylock, and I recommend that. I saw it myself here in Milwaukee a few weeks ago before I went to Antarctica, and it's a great film. I recommend it to everybody. I think it's being shown all around the country. And, in fact, you can see most of what's in that film in a NOVA film, public television, a PBS film, I think, through WGBH in Boston, entitled Extreme Ice. So if you look up the film Extreme Ice, you can purchase one of these or maybe access it online yourself. But it really does a great job of documenting the worldwide meltdown of glaciers of ice. And as I often tell my class, when I look outside my kitchen window and I see the icicles, because I don't have enough insulation in my roof, when I see the icicles outside my kitchen window and they've been there for several weeks, we don't see that much anymore. But when I see those icicles start to melt, brilliant guy that I am, I realize, hey, it must be getting warmer outside. The icicles are melting. That's what's happening on the planet. That's what the glaciers of the planet and the sea ice and all of the ice on the planet is telling us, the thawing Arctic, the melting Antarctic Peninsula, all the glaciers in the mountain ranges of the world, Greenland, Antarctica, they're melting. They're telling us that, just like my icicle, the world, the planet is warming up. Not just the air outside my Wauwatosa window. The whole planet is warming up, and that's what the ice is telling us. And that ice is really the planet's thermometer. We've got to listen to it. We've got to listen to it. The Heartland Institute, there are a lot of groups that are sort of professional deniers. One thing you have to realize is that the principal cause of global warming, of anthropogenic climate change, which is so significant and having major impacts around the world right now, is the combustion of fossil fuels. And when you start to think about the economics, this is really a tough problem, because the economies of the world over the last two centuries have developed using fossil fuels as the principal energy source. We're going to have to transition away from that, no question about it. But the fossil fuel industry has been the most profitable industry in the history of human civilization. And naturally, they don't want things to change. And so a lot of denialists and skeptics are funded and encouraged and even organized by represent economic interests who perceive that this is not in their best interest. I think enlightened self-interest would tell them that the way to go is alternative energy. But there's that book you mentioned, Merchants of Doubt, I recommend it highly. The author is Naomi Oreskes, and she goes all the way back to the 1950s and the 1960s and reviews the propaganda campaign against discouraging cigarette smoking. I mean, the tobacco industry didn't want people to know that it was bad for your health. You might remember it was only about 20 years ago that a lot of the CEOs of the tobacco companies got up in Congress, raised their right hand, and swore that nicotine was not addicting. Naomi Oreskes traces this whole enterprise of disinformation, of denialist propaganda, back to the cigarettes, applies the same principles, and a lot of the same people are involved to the current denialist campaign and disinformation propaganda regarding global warming. And that's it's an excellent book. I'm glad you raised that. We had her actually 2 years ago at the Green Energy Summit as a keynote speaker. Oh.
Thanks, Ned, so much for the call. Eugene and Viola, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen, and to your guest. I'm wondering if your guest could speak to global warming and how it's going to affect our continuing lack of moisture here in the Midwest, shipping on the Mississippi and level of the Great Lakes, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Eugene.
Well, it's a very serious threat there, and it's an economic threat. It's a threat to people's lifestyles and livelihoods and the economy of the region and the nation and the world, really. It's all predicted by the climate models, which, you know what a climate model is? It's a computer, I guess it's a whole series of algorithms, but it's a computer model which takes all the variables that affect climate. It takes all the fundamental laws of nature and physics, such as gravity and thermodynamics, and puts them into a model. And then if it's well constructed, it should be able to predict. Well, how do you test it? You predict the past. We have the data of what the past climates have been. So if your climate model can predict the past, then you have a pretty good confidence that it can predict the future. And what these models show is that there are going to be major changes, which are already underway, in the climate systems, the climatic patterns around the world. And these climatic patterns are the patterns under which civilization has developed. For rainfall, for growing crops, the fundamental necessities of life, food and water. These are changing, and we've seen that here in the Midwest. Record-breaking droughts, prolonged droughts, record-breaking heat waves, and this is devastating to a lot of crops. It's devastating to the economics of these commodities worldwide, in addition, which affects people all around the world. So these are very serious problems. The lowering of the Mississippi River, that has been predicted for a long time also, and of course a lot of there's a lot of commerce comes down the river, and when the water level gets too low and those barges and those ships can't navigate the river, that affects the economy of the whole region as well as the rest of the world. So these are really serious problems, and I think we're going to see this problem addressed when it really starts, when the economic impacts, the negative economic impacts, really begin to sink in for people, that this is devastating to the basic necessities, water supply, food supply, not only here, to the economies of the region and of the entire world. When people begin to see the expense, then they're going to start taking it seriously. And, of course, extreme weather and climate events are what we expect from global warming. They're predicted by all the climate models. We saw some great examples, or some terrible examples, I should say, such as Hurricane Sandy, such as the many droughts, the wildfires in the West, and the beetle outbreaks in the forests of Western North America. These are due to prolonged droughts and heat waves and the lack of extremely cold temperatures, which normally control the larvae of these beetles that are killing the trees. So we don't realize the cost of this, and the taxpayers are getting stuck with these additional expenses that are piling up more and more and more every year, rather than those who are really perpetrating them. And when the economics gets figured in, when the fossil fuel industry bears some of the cost of the negative impacts, what they like to call externalities, the negative impacts of burning their fuels, then that'll raise the price of those fuels, and the alternatives, such as renewable energy, will have a fair marketplace. Right now, it's not a fair marketplace. We're still subsidizing exploration for oil and gas, and we're not even renewing any incentives for the alternatives. So that's all got to change. It's just got to change, and the sooner the better.
Well, you can only have so many events like a Hurricane Sandy before you really are forced to change, right? Because we can't afford to rebuild all that has to be rebuilt after a huge, huge, devastating storm like that.
Oh, that's right. And the frequency and the intensity of these kinds of storms, these extreme weather events, Kathleen, has increased dramatically over the past four decades. The big insurance companies, the reinsurance companies, as they're called, that insure the smaller insurance companies, like Lloyd's of London and Swiss Re and Munich Re, they know this because their data clearly show an increase in frequency and intensity of these extreme weather and climate events. And in fact, Munich Re issued a major report just this past October documenting these changes. And in many places, such as along the Gulf Coast and the Atlantic Coast of the U.S., you can't even get insurance for property along the coast now because the risk factor, the risk of storm surge, coupled with rising sea level and the increased intensity and frequency of storms, makes it uneconomical for the insurance companies to even offer insurance. Or if they do, the premiums are going way up. So a lot of people are already bearing the cost. And remember what happened after Hurricane Sandy. Governor Cuomo of New York asked for a $40 billion federal emergency disaster relief loans. And Governor Christie of New Jersey, same thing, $29 billion. So that's almost $70 billion in federal loans. That's taxpayer money. You know, this is really already costing everybody. And we need to realize this. And it's kind of, we need to start paying attention to that great American hero, Ben Franklin. You know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And we're not doing any prevention right now, and we're going to pay many, 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 many pounds. The longer we wait, the more pounds of cure it's going to take. So that was sage advice, universal and timeless advice from one of our founding fathers that we ought to pay attention to.
Norda in Eagle River, hi. Hello? Well, she's not there, or he's not there. Let's go to Chris in Milwaukee. Hi, Chris.
In 1969, I was at the highest point in Germany near the Austrian border, and I looked out the window of a ski resort, and I saw snow and whiteness. Now, informally, when I look at current website images of the same area, it looks like there's more exposed rock and soil. I have not, it's a dramatic difference. I don't know if I'm looking at a difference in terms of season. I'm guessing not. Am I alone? Have other people noticed this? This is awfully dramatic, what I've seen.
No, you're not alone, Chris, and thanks very much for contributing that observation. It's happening all over. I attended a conference in Bern, Switzerland, and we also went over into Austria and Germany. But in Bern, Switzerland, the summer before last, in August of 2011, where I gave a paper titled Climate Change Mitigation, an International Imperative. And we went on a geological field trip up to view the Aletsch Glacier, which is the longest glacier in the Alps. It's about 21 kilometers long. Wouldn't that be about 13 miles long? And it has shrunk way back. You can, and just, it's continuing to shrink back year after year after year. You can see from the moraines and the deposits that the melting ice left where it was. And there are markers to show where it has been in previous years. That's happening throughout the Alps and throughout the world. And a lot of ski resorts are really in trouble because they're way downhill from where the glaciers and the snow, permanent snow is that they depend on for their livelihood. And you could make an analogy to Wisconsin as well. I mean, the central and northern parts of our great state, their economies depend to a significant degree on winter sports. Skiing, cross-country skiing, snowshoeing, snowmobiling, and all, ice fishing and all the rest. And our winters are becoming shorter. John Magnuson over at UW-Madison did a great study of Lake Mendota, which was later extended to many lakes in the northern states. And what he did was he found that the fall freeze-up time for Lake Mendota has been getting later and later and later in the fall, and the spring thaw time for the lake has been getting earlier and earlier in the spring, so that the time that the lake is frozen over is shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. And these records go back to, I think, 1860. They found this is true for lakes all across the northern states, so Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, New York State. And this is a very well-documented trend. And it has effects on the lakes, emphasizing local impacts, because the shorter the period of ice cover, that means the longer the period of water, liquid water, for evaporation. And a lot of these lakes are getting lower and lower because they're evaporating more, not only because there's less ice cover in the winter, but also because the temperature is getting warmer. So there are all kinds of impacts, and the shrinking back of glaciers in the mountains is an important one. And another point there, Chris, in the Himalaya, or the Himalayas, many of the great rivers of Asia rise or have their source in the Himalayan range. And those glaciers are melting back, and literally a couple of billion people depend upon these rivers for their water supply. So we're looking at some really fundamental issues, such as sea level rise, which is inundating shallow islands and causing people to have to move inland or migrate. These are fundamental issues, and we're part of it, and we have to start doing something about it.
Thank you, Chris, for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is George Thomas Stone. He teaches a range of courses in the earth sciences at MATC, and he has a longstanding interest in climate change. We're talking to him today because he recently returned from a three-week expedition to Antarctica to study climate change. It was sponsored by the Geological Society of America, a number of scientists on that trip, and the message he said he brought back is, save the planet now. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls now, let's go to Virginia in Milwaukee. Hello, Virginia.
Good morning, Kathleen, to you and your guest, Mr. Stone. Boy, Mr. Stone, I attended classes at MATC some years ago, and boy, I certainly would have loved to have you for an instructor. You have just a plethora of knowledge about what's going on here as far as global warming. So your students are going to certainly learn a lot. And I guess my main question is, excuse me, I've got Rachel Carson here. I'm looking at a flyer I've got up here about one person making a difference. And Rachel Carson was a biologist, I believe, a scientist, and she made a difference, even changing her government, our government, by writing Silent Spring I think it was the 50s. And what I want to know is, how can each one of us make our small impact? Because I think that each one of us can make a difference. It's been done in other aspects of social change, and how can we do this, Mr. Stone?
Well, that's a great question, Virginia. I appreciate it. You know, Rachel Carson was, I think Silent Spring was published in 1962. She was a biologist who worked for the federal government, and she had a lot of pushback about publishing her report, which essentially said that the unnecessary and reckless use of man-made chemicals was ruining the environment. And she had in mind, in specific, DDT, which was used as a pesticide to kill insects such as mosquitoes. And it was getting into the food chain and killing birds and in a domino effect, having a devastating effect, introducing these toxins into the environment. And I think, as much as anybody else, Rachel Carson deserves the credit for awakening the environmental movement in this country and to some extent worldwide in the 1960s. Of course, we've got some great contributors to the environmental ethic and the environmental movement in Wisconsin, going back all the way to John Muir's growing up in Wisconsin, and then, of course, the great Aldo Leopold, and more recently, Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day. So we have contributed a lot to the environmental movement, and we should recapture that leadership. And there's no better issue on which to focus that energy than this greatest environmental threat in the history of human civilization, which we call global warming. There's no question about it. It has the potential to devastate ecosystems throughout the planet, all over the planet. And destroy the future economy of the world. So it's going to affect, it's a threat to everyone. And we have this great responsibility. I think this has been one of the great contributions of the United States to the world, has been our leadership in conservation. Now we call it primarily sustainability, but in conservation and environmental concerns, environmental stewardship, going all the way back to when Abraham Lincoln gave the Yosemite area to California so that they could set up a state park to preserve it in 1864, then the first national park in 1872 under U.S. Grant, and then Theodore Roosevelt. Notice these are all Republican presidents. Theodore Roosevelt, the first decade of the century, established the forest system, the United States Forest Service, National Forest, and National Monuments, and then on up all through the 60s. When President Nixon signed the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, and we had in the 60s the Endangered Species Act and the Wilderness Act, all of those, we were the leaders for the world, and the concept of preserving nature, national parks, that's a concept that we gave to the world, and we inherited, of course, from the Native Americans, who think that we do have a responsibility for at least seven generations into the future to preserve the environment. But in recent decades, I think it dates back to the 80s, we have abandoned that world leadership in conservation and environmental stewardship. We've got to reassert that leadership. The world is waiting for our leadership on this particular issue. And Virginia, there are lots of organizations you can join. One of them is 350.org, and there are lots of climate action organizations which you can join right here in Wisconsin. In fact, we're having an organizing session at the Sustainability Summit, March 6th and 7th, here in Milwaukee. Of all these organizations, they're going to form a Wisconsin Climate Action Coalition. We've got to exert pressure. Now, let me summarize my response to your great point in two ways. One, personal lifestyle. You can reduce your own personal carbon footprint by using less energy. You turn down the thermostat a little bit, walk sometimes instead of driving, and so forth. We know recycle. We know what those lifestyle ways are. But we also must be politically active, because public policy, major public policy decisions are going to be necessary to get this problem under control. And that means our representatives at every level, city, county, state, national, and even international at these international conferences. We need to make our voices heard and put pressure on our representatives at every level to take this problem seriously, to grow up and be responsible and take action to get it under control. And Margaret Mead was another great woman in the history of science, primarily an anthropologist, and you see a lot of T-shirts with her quote. I'm going to have to paraphrase, but she said that every great movement that's ever accomplished something started with a small group of people. And that's what we have to do. This, we can't wait for top down. We have to push this from the bottom up. So thank you for your call.
Thanks, Virginia. I'm wondering, I was thinking about your trip again, wondering if you or the Geological Society have, you must have extraordinary pictures from this journey, don't you?
Oh, I certainly do. I think I took 5,400 images.
Whoa, George. Where can we see them? Can we see them?
Well, we're going to start putting them up on the MATC website. I'm working with Kathleen Hole, our communications director, and she has asked for the slides, and I'm going to give her access to as many as she wants. So we'll be putting them up on the MATC website very soon.
Good. Okay. Thank you very much for the call. And let us go to Wade. We have about less than a minute left. Hi, Wade, in Turtle Lake.
Hello. As far as on the topic of personal carbon footprint, we need to think about the amount of heat loss in our homes. Yeah, I know your professor talked about the icicles dripping off his roof. And it's what can we do, each of us, to help out? I mean, people are buying hybrid cars and electric vehicles, and they just need to think about what they can do, you know, by looking around, looking if their ice is, if they're forming icicles on their roof or, you know, heat loss. So,
Right. Well, that's right, we have a great point, Wade.
Yeah, that is. Thank you very much, Wade, for the call. Thank you so much, George. It was a fascinating article. Thank you for being with us, and we'll talk again before the summit.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Thank you so much, Kathleen.
Our guest this hour, George Thomas Stone, just returned from a three-week expedition to Antarctica to study climate change, a trip that was sponsored by the Geological Society of America. Many scientists accompanied him on that journey. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and for doing all the on-air production as well. Thank you, everybody, for your interest and for calling in. Great conversations ahead. Stay tuned for Larry Mueller momentarily, and we'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock.